tension and energy might be flagging, but hopefully you can carry through with us. The final talk. This actually builds on ideas of imitation and innovation, but now applied to American poetry in the case of the haiku. So, to begin, a provocation. The most popular and widely disseminated foreign poetic texts in America in the early 20th century were not French or German, but rather Chinese and Japanese. Here's a map of foreign translations of poetry into the United States during the height of American modernism. Journals are in yellow, the edges again indicate translations. So the red lines here are translations of Chinese and Japanese poetry, and somewhat surprisingly, the majority of translations are from ancient East Asian poets such as Du Fu, Li Po, and others. However, what's startling about the map is not just how prominent translations from East Asia were, but how widely dispersed they were across the entire literary field. So there's something about poetry from East Asia that made it socially desirable across a spectrum of different poetic communities. Something about the East Asian text that made it the object of a collective chatter, we'll call it, across the entire publication network. But how to conceptualize this desire at the scale of the network? How to understand the precise interplay between text and system? The popularity of the English language haiku in the teens, a critical part of this chatter, offers a rich opportunity to explore these questions. So we start with a close reading at the scale of the individual text. What is an American or English language haiku? But to most of us, there's a set of fairly legible and normative criteria that define the haiku. Haikus are short, they consist of a syllabic pattern of 5, 7, 5, broken down into 3 lines, and they possess rich natural imagery at the expense of lyrical subjectivity. There's a strong sense that you know one when you see one, and scholars have in fact produced a set of more precise analytical categories to discern the American haiku. One of these scholars, Earl Miner, characterized it by its brevity and intensity, the poet's ability to escape the confinement of the poem. In its Japanese incarnation, Miner claims that this sense of liberation is usually accomplished through references to time and space. The Japanese haiku contains not only a reference to a season, an indication of time, but also an image of nature, that of space. More poetically, Yonin Noguchi, Ezra Pound's Japanese collaborator, asserts that the haiku literally means a single utterance or the utterance of a single verse. That utterance should be like a moth lightly playing on reality's dusk. Noguchi, along with Anglo-American modernists such as Pound and Amy Lowell, helped to define the various categories today associated with haiku in English. Again, brevity, intense imagery, and suggestiveness. Over time, American readers have adopted this more figural criteria in recognizing haiku. Haiku are a matter of sensibility and aesthetic disposition, not merely just this 5-7 arrangement of syllables. Now there's actually another strand of modernist thinking about the haiku that focuses on its sociological effects as much as its formal properties. In their now canonical survey of modernist poetry from 1927, Laura Riding and Robert Graves sought to advance a vision of modernism by associating it with a set of proto-new critical principles, such as the autonomy of the poetic object. But scanning the modern field of poetry, they find much to bemoan and criticize. In particular, they argue the problem of modern poetry is that there is too much imitation. And here, somewhat starkly, they focus on the English language haiku, or hokku, as it was then called, as particularly guilty of both representing and enabling this trend. Too much poetry was being written, a lot of clutter resulting in what they call parasitical imitativeness. One can no longer distinguish imitation from innovation, and the haiku is exemplary of this state of affairs. And they tried to diagnose the problem with precisely 4 representative examples. I'll let you look at these for a moment. So the lines of the dots indicate the break between the poems. So they threw up these 4 examples, and then they offered this, what they called a literary plot of where things had gone wrong. Who was the inventor of the style of the first 2 pieces, they asked? Mr. Aldington or Mr. Williams, or yet H.D. or F.S. Flint? In the last 2 pieces, who is responsible for the form? Who first thought of imitating the Japanese hokku form? Or rather, who first thought of imitating the French imitation of the hokku form? Did Mr. Aldington suggest a slightly shorter poem to Mr. Stevens or Mr. Pound? Or did Mr. Pound suggest a slightly longer poem to Mr. Aldington, etc.? Or did Mr. Pound and Mr. Stevens, and on and on. So they're trying to sort of think about like what was that initial moment, that origin of the haiku as it was received and then took off in avant-garde poetic circles. What is intriguing about this description is that it defines the haiku not by its formal properties or traits, but by its sociological effects. That is, the beef that writing and Graves seem to have with the haiku lies in its embodiment and inspiration of imitativeness, which they argue has come to degrade the overall literary field. They read the haiku as not a single thing or entity, but a group mentality or aggregate disposition. They read it at the scale of the institution. Now, their grumpy take on the English language haiku raises several questions. The first is largely formalist. Why did they single out the haiku and these specific texts as the epitome of imitative verse? But this question immediately begs a bigger one. What about the haiku forced them into a more sprawling, distant form of reading? And for our purpose today, what is the relationship between these scales of interpretation? Can we mediate between them to understand the haiku's unique formal traits as engendering broader sociological patterns of literary imitation and influence at the scale of the poetic field? Writing and Graves offer a natural bridge to thinking across these different scales, despite their desire to ultimately burn that same bridge.
So the next scale we want to look at is that of cultural history before we get to data. What does the haiku look like through that lens? The story of the haiku was, of how the haiku was introduced into Anglo-American poetry is well-trodden ground. It begins at the turn of the 20th century when scholars and collectors of things oriental introduced the haiku to academic and intellectual audiences through extended treatises and translations. The second moment involved experimental adoptions of the form in the early teens by a tight-knit circle of avant-garde English and American poets, working in dialogue with native informants like Yona Noguchi. This is the phase to which Pound's Alba, the 1912 poem cited by Writing Graves, belongs. Following this phase is a third, less well-documented period of wider acceptance and diffusion, and indeed of oversaturation. The fourth poem above, from Stevens's 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, fits into this phase, along with other poems by W.C. Williams, Carl Sandburg, and others. Big data, at least in the primitive form of Google's N-gram viewer, would seem to corroborate this narrative. If we look at occurrences of the terms hoku, haikai, and haiku between 1890 and 1930, we see a significant rise in these terms. All three were used synonymously for what we today think of as haiku, though they are technically distinct. It's worth fleshing out just a bit longer, this cultural history. Phase one, the discovery phase, was all about collecting and specimen gathering. What stands out for the literary curio seekers of this phase are primarily two features of the hoku, its brevity and suggestiveness. These qualities fascinated Anglo-American poets the most, although not enough to be seen as advantageous to English poetry or worthy of imitating. As one critic puts it, this is great, an English poet would feel naked in a hoku. He would feel as if he were clothed in a Japanese fan. The hoku texts from this phase are primarily translations, then as opposed to experimentations, as in phase two, but they are nevertheless provided the foundation upon which later phases were built. Phase two begins around 1913. In this year, there appears a nexus of poets intensely attracted to the aesthetic possibilities of the hoku, and who retroactively note its foundational role in the movement. Three things stand out in the second stage of the hoku's acceptance. First, its cliquish nature, allowing those involved to reinforce each other's interest in this new innovation. Second, an emerging agreement about what made it so compelling, namely, again, brevity, suggestion, and natural imagery. And third, a sense that it was an innovation both easy to implement and whose effects were immediately visible. So famously, Pounds in the station of the Metro, super famous. The haiku's easily observable form allowed poets and critics to recognize hoku-like poems, much as Writing and Graves did. But if they needed only four examples to make their case, we need something more like 400, both to adequately represent this notion of chatter, but also because the computational processes we wanted to employ to do pattern recognition depend on lots of data. Thus, we set out to build a hoku corpus and selected poems based on the following criteria. This is very, very important, so we're not misunderstood. There's a logic to it. The poem had to self-identify as a hoku in its title, or the poem had to be identified explicitly by the author as a hoku, or the poem had to have been recognized by later scholars like Earl Minor as having been influenced by the Hokku. So we didn't pick them at random or stack the deck. We also included translations of haiku from the initial discovery phase, limiting ourselves to the sources most commonly cited in phase two. In total, we found over 400 texts that fit these relatively constrained criteria, and here's their distribution over time. Note how many there are in the late teens and early 20s. This is phase three, America's first haiku craze. At the same time, some critics remarked on the craze as evidence of a close rapprochement of East and West. Others called to put a stop to the madness. This is great. Less kind was a satirical magazine, Siren, and mocked the Hoku's highbrow associations, enclosed with a refrain in 5-7 form, "Do you think there is anything in this Hoku stuff? Neither do I." The Hoku, it seems, had truly arrived. But how exactly and how far had it spread in this third phase? Was poetry really getting shorter? We can partly answer this last question. Considering Poetry Magazine as a bellwether, a graph of average and median poem length reveals a decreasing trend with a considerable dip between 16 and 1917. It'd be silly to think this was all the Hoku's doing. More likely, as with any successful innovation, Hoku was part of a cluster of other poetic innovations arising interdependently. Innovations tied to changing attitudes amongst poets about brevity, imagism, and subjectiveness. But then how to trace the specific influence of Hoku within this more general shift? Here we need an approach that at once is more fine-grained than cultural history, but also scalable to large volumes of text. Our contention is that to fully understand the haiku as a kind of sociological chatter, and again, we mean this in a kind of, in a kind of almost like counter Bourdieuian sense, in that it doesn't follow cultural capital patterns, it's just this randomly diffused. We need to supplement close reading and historical narrative with methods that facilitate broader pattern detection. One such method combines machine learning algorithms with text classification, but it requires a very different approach to the text itself, not as an object to be read or counted, but operationalized as a set of discrete linguistic and stylistic features detectable across many hundreds of instances.
Right. So I want to explain sort of the process of the machine learning process and its sort of the technical nature of it, how we went about this, and then Richard will finish with comments on sort of the epistemological questions raised by it. So machine learning is basically, it's a technique to take two distinct corpora, distinct in some measure, and compare them against one another based on a set of features that you specify. Now, whatever the features chosen, the assumption is that they manifest distinctly in each corpus. So one feature, for example, might be the kinds of words used in that corpus, diction. And in text classification, this is called the bag of words representation. And this slide shows how you would transform a single text into a bag of words. So we have one text, one of the texts from our corpuses as raw text. It's a translation. The next stage is to tokenize it into a bag of words, and then a further step is to basically take out these stop words or function words. So keep in mind that word order does not matter in this representation. After doing this for all the texts in your two corpora, whatever you're looking at, then you can label the text accordingly as belonging to one corpus or the other, like spam and not spam, or in our case, haiku and not haiku. And then comes the machine learning part. I'm sure you've seen this figure 1,000 times. This is the machine learning guy at his computer. He's using basically a random sample of some portion of the text from each corpus. So you take a random sample from your two corpora, and the machine is trained to basically learn which features are more likely to be associated with which class, which group of text. So if your features are based on the words used in text as they are for us, then you end up with something like this. Which are basically probability measures for which words are more likely to predict which class of text. So in this case, this set of results, sky was 5.7 times more likely to predict a not haiku poem, whereas snow was more likely to predict a haiku poem. These measures, as an aggregate, are used to then classify a second set of texts, which is called your test set, where the labels have been held out. And basically here, the machine tries to predict the class to which each of these test texts belongs based on what it learned from the training data. The machine essentially looks at the features of each text, the words, and asks the following. Given how many times I saw this word associated with the haiku group, and given how many times I saw it associated with the non-haiku group, what's the probability that this new text I see belongs to either one of those groups? And then takes the joint probability of all those words in the unknown text and assigns it to the class it thinks it belongs to. So in our case, the two corpora we classify against each other are a subset, basically, of our hokku against a subset of short poems, what we call short poems, from several key journals of the period. As for features, there are two that we can fairly easily implement. One is brevity, right, which we can pre-select for by taking only the poems that are at least as short as the average length of our hokku texts, which was somewhere around 250 characters. And then the second feature is diction, using this bag of words approach. And we use that, we represent every text as the set of words by which it's composed, excluding function words, and then aggregate this feature over the entirety of each corpus. So the idea here is that by identifying the words typically used in either translated hokku or native English hokku, we can then test to see if other short poems from the time use these same words and whether that might be some kind of gauge of their hokku-ness. So given the historical phases that we talked about, we decided to implement this test in two ways. First, take the pre-1914, the mostly translated texts, and classify them against short poems. And then take the post-1914 texts, which are more of these sort of adaptations, English language haiku, and classify them against the same short poems. So the first is going to tell us something about how the diction of translated haiku, you know, sort of leached into haiku in later years. And then the second test is going to tell us if the vocabulary of English hokku were similarly sort of carried over into the haiku craze. So what happened when we did this? When we subjected our text to this admittedly reductive but scalable ontology of poetic form? One of the baseline measures that machine learning provides is an accuracy score, which is determined by the number of texts the algorithm guesses correctly. So the accuracy scores here are basically averages for multiple tests run in those ways that I've just described. The pre-1914 on the bottom and the post-1914 on top, and we have several journals, Poetry Magazine, Little Review, Avant-Garde, you know, Modernist Journal, others, Contemporary Verse, kind of a middle-brow journal, Smart Set, which was based out of New York, and then The Masses, which is a leftist journal. Okay. What can we make of these results? Essentially, you'll notice that the accuracy rates don't vary all that much. They're a little higher for pre-1914 hokku than for post-1914 hokku, and a little higher for some journals than others. So one of the things the results suggest is the pre-1914 hokku are slightly more distinct in their word patterns than post-1914 hokku, and thus easier to classify. And this seems right, because translations were drawing from a more limited set of words, or limited set of poems. The results also point to variations in kinds of short poems being published in each journal, as we would expect. For along with these accuracy scores come lists of misclassified poems, and we find that many more of these misclassified poems, which Richard will talk about in a second, they appear in the decidedly modernist journals like Poetry, Little Review, and others. So, the results also alert us, however, to a potential problem. You know, if we're expecting to find hokku in these collections of short poems and yet training the machine to learn all of them as not hokku, doesn't this somehow confound our classification process? Our accuracy scores may be lower overall, that is, because the corpora we're comparing, at least in terms of diction, aren't that distinct enough to begin with. We're not dealing with decidedly non-spam and spam kinds of texts. There's something different. So one response to sort of help correct this would be to create a richer model of the hokku by isolating some other key feature. We've tried this with a syllable count, since it's an obvious choice, and given how essential it is to the form and its original Japanese manifestation. We don't have time to go into the details here, but you know, our expectation, we basically counted the syllables in each of the poems in our corpus, our expectation is that they wouldn't really conform to the 575 mode, because we know a lot of these poets in English felt that was too restrictive. But what's interesting is that the majority of the pre-1914 hokku grouped right around 16 to 20 syllables, 17 is the magic number, whereas in the post-1914 hokku, they grouped either around 16 to 22, but also one group around 30 syllables, which is close, very close to another prominent poetic form called the tanka, which is 5-7-5-7-7, and was sort of seen almost as similar, as the same sort of genre as haiku at this time. When we built this information into our classifier, we actually, so this is the results with the syllables, it did improve the accuracy scores, and we're happy to go into the details of what this might mean, but it tells us that syllable count might be another important feature in terms of classification.
Smart says like the N plus one of their time. I just want to say that.
Okay, so
what does this all mean? What are we doing? We're using these machine learning approaches on poetry. Does it make any sense from a humanist perspective? What does all this mean? How does the epistemology of the machine or computational algorithm differ from that of the human mind? I think this is the thing really animating what we're doing. Can we put them together? Why are they different? How are they different? Are they different in interesting ways? What does it mean to dissolve a literary text into a bag of words that fill vector and matrix spaces rather than pages? It obviously robs a text of literary meaning insofar as the machine only accounts for the presence and the relative frequency of individual words. As humanists, textual meaning for us lies precisely in the way these words are put together to generate figurative language. But we also see it as a product of expert nuanced interpretation and not reducible to crude probability measures. In judging how two texts relate, or in classifying text as of a particular style, we want to rely on our prior knowledge and a refined bellatristic sensibility, not a limited set of empirical features that identify their closeness or non-proximity to each other based on how many of these features they share, something very empirical. One common criticism of computational methods as applied to literary texts is that they aren't precise enough, they're not sensitive enough to capture the many different features of a text, that they will only be useful once we refine them to be the same as or identical to expert human interpretation. So the perfect classifier is a human being, or like Earl Miner, like a really, really good poetry critic. But this misses the point of such methods. The goal is not to build the perfect haiku detector or to make the machine symmetrical with a human eye. That's not the point. Rather, we are interested in what a computer epistemology thinks a haiku is based on features we define for it. It's rather narrow to say that only humans can identify poetic form or style, implying that there is nothing machinic or routinized about how we do so. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. It's quite machinic how we write. What if we compared our own vision with that of the machine? What might that tell us about the formal attributes that constituted the English language haiku, or about their dissemination across a wider field? The ontology of the haiku alters depending on the epistemology we subject it to, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. We can't underscore this enough. Indeed, things get really interesting when we start to read closely the so-called misclassified poems in our experiment. Again, these are poems that the machine guesses to be a haiku, but which are labeled as non-haiku and come from one of the six journals in our corpus. So there's some disagreement between human and machine. The term misclassify, though, is a slight misnomer. It describes text that we as literary critics did not judge to be a haiku. Remember that our only condition for inclusion was length, but which the machine thinks it is a haiku. Thus, the term indexes the epistemology of the machine as expressed through the examples of haiku that we provided it. Here are three of these so-called misclassified or not human-identified haiku. The first is Amy Lowell's, One of the 100 Views of Fuji. Okay, this one's not surprising at all, and so not a big deal. But others are very surprising, such as this random poem published in The Masses, 1917, a leftist labor journal, which does not resemble remotely our humanist conceptions of what a haiku should look like. And finally, there are those that fall somewhere in between these two poles. The last one about the cat. The first poem by Lowell, we can safely say, is a haiku in waiting that the machine helped us to discover. This is perhaps the most predictable use of computational methods to assist with literary criticism. But the other two are also interesting. One reaction might be that the algorithm is flawed because it doesn't align with our intuitions as literary scholars. Machine bad because not like human. But if we take seriously the machine's approach to classification as internally logical, as catching something about the English language haiku that is invisible at the level of several texts, invisible at the human eye, but necessarily present at the level of several hundred, at least according to the probabilistic ways in which the machine thinks. Here, close reading re-enters the picture. Do any of these misclassified haikus bear evidence of the suggestiveness that Pounder Minor saw as emblematic of the form? Do any possess the, quote, parasitical inter-imitativeness that Ridey and Graves discern as the key to the American haiku? Would you be persuaded if we told you that the third example was written by William Carlos Williams in 1919? By close reading these texts, we can try to reverse engineer the machine's decision process and intuit what about it that the computer thought it was haiku-esque, or it is a haiku. So what do we gain by taking seriously the epistemology of the machine? The primary payoff is that we can discern the dissemination of the haiku at a scale previously unimaginable. Doing so necessarily means that we have to flatten the poetic text according to parameters such as diction and syllable count that we as literary critics find wanting. But by taking seriously the machine's capacity to identify form and style according to its own coherent logic, we scale up our capacity to discover broader textual patterns. And indeed, it's not as if the machine is giving us nonsense. Here are a few more misclassifications to consider. What we want to do now is to take these misclassifications and expose them in our network maps to provide a rough plot of how the haiku form diffused through channels other than those conventionally exposed by scholarship. So we have like 400 in the bigger field, but then we have another like 2,000 that the machine helps us find that have a kind of haiku-ness. A history of the haiku from the perspective of the machine, but also a history that feeds back into a human understanding of it as constituting a broader sociological chatter that permeated every corner of American poetic culture, not just the elite spaces of modernism. So you can think of it as haiku as both Gangnam Style as well as Radiohead, as both a kind of meaningless chatter in society, as well as a kind of Bourdieuian accreted cultural capital thing. In a sense, this history back brings us back to where we started. Ridey and Graves too sought to track the patterns of imitation that plagued modernism, feeling the haiku to be simply in the air, a germ to which less creative poets were susceptible. They wanted to find the machine form, whereas we've gone and found form in the machine. And yet by using computational methods to discern broader patterns of textual relation, we've also circled back to human interpretation to rethink what precisely was machinic or imitative in the diffusion of haiku, and to rethink the very ontology of the poetic text. And here, this would be worth talking about in relation to Jennifer's talk, because she provides another model to think about how meaning forms ground up from authors. So you can think of computational, ground up communities, and then also just a top-down elite textual analysis of this categorization. So yeah, to rethink the very ontology of the poetic text as somewhere between intuition and probability, between reading and algorithm. Thanks.